This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The boundary between land and sea is constantly changing here in eastern North Carolina, but that hasn't stopped us from trying to control it. Everywhere you go, in Beaufort and Morehead City, New Bern and Oriental, you're likely to find bulkheads and seawalls protecting the shoreline from erosion and keeping water from encroaching on homes and businesses. According to the North Carolina Coastal Federation, as many as 20 miles of the state's estuarine shorelines are walled or rocked every year. But these wood or concrete structures may actually do more harm than good. Rachel Goodman is a recent PhD graduate from the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City.
Bulkheads, particularly when they lack any kind of vegetation, tend to support lower abundances and diversity of fish and crustaceans, also of benthic infauna, so invertebrates that fish are feeding on. They tend to induce a kind of a scour or deepening of the shallow subtidal habitat, which can actually reduce the amount of suitable habitat for juvenile fish and crustaceans.
In high wave action areas, man-made bulkheads make the most sense, but for low to medium wave areas, such as rivers, estuaries, and soundside properties, living shorelines can be more cost-effective, better for the environment, and more resilient. These protective barriers are constructed in shallow water, often in areas susceptible to erosion. Bags of stone, gravel, or oyster shells are placed on top of another, creating a wall about 12 to 18 inches high that runs parallel to shore. North Carolina Coastal Federation scientist Dr. Lexia Weaver says thousands of plugs of native seagrass are planted behind the structure.
So it not only looks very aesthetic and appealing, but it also functions really well in preventing erosion, protection from storms, and creating good oyster and salt marsh wetland habitat.
Tiny oyster larvae freely float through the water column until they find something to attach to, such as the rock or shell substrate of a living shoreline. Over time, the spat grow into oysters and eventually becomes a living oyster reef. This is beneficial to the environment, since a single adult oyster can filter and clean 20 to 50 gallons of water per day. Goodman says living shorelines also provide suitable habitat and food for a number of fish and crustaceans.
It's a nursery for a lot of both commercial and recreationally valuable species, and also the species that those fish feed upon. So blue crabs love this shallow, structured habitat. You'll find juvenile red drum, you'll find juvenile speckled trout, lots of pinfish and pigfish, lots of shrimp also use this structured habitat.
Given they slow erosion, provide habitat, and improve water quality, living shorelines seem like a promising venture. But before they become the accepted approach for erosion control, there are challenges to overcome. For instance, Goodman says the permitting process for building a living shoreline is more arduous than for the construction of a traditional bulkhead.
The other major issue is availability of materials. Oyster shell would be a preferred option for doing living shoreline work, but it's not necessarily available to every homeowner here, and granite and other structures can be expensive. Contractors are not as familiar with constructing living shorelines, and so they can often be hesitant to recommend that to a private property owner.
The North Carolina Coastal Federation is hoping to address that issue with an upcoming project at our coast. A $75,000 grant was awarded from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for the construction of 2,000 linear feet of living shorelines in local sounds, bays, rivers, and waterways. Part of the grant funding will be used to train marine contractors in the design and implementation of living shorelines. Today, Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with Coastal Federation scientist Dr. Lexia Weaver about the three-year project and how homeowners in our area can apply for the cost share program.
As of 2014, Lexia, there were 45 permitted living shorelines here along the coast in eastern North Carolina, including Taylor's Creek at Beaufort, Morehead City, Atlantic Beach, Emerald Isle, as well as Jones Island and the White Oak River area. Now, with this new grant money, are there other areas along the Central Coast where the living shorelines look promising?
Yes. So basically, any area that is showing some sort of erosion, whether it's from boat wakes or from tropical storms and hurricanes that we've been having, the area that
mostly looks promising in this part of the state, and although these will be put in along the entire coast of North Carolina, is Bogue Sound. Both the northern and southern portions of Bogue Sound have areas that are eroding, and I have been contacted in the past several years by waterfront property owners in those areas that have exhibited some problems and erosion that they've seen through the years.
Now, how long does it take to build up a living shoreline, and how is its long-term success measured?
Well, it takes about 2 or 3 years for a living shoreline to get fully established. The first year involves the planting and or the installation of the offshore structure, whether it's the oyster shell bags or the riprap or the rock offshore. But the plants typically take about 2 to 3 years to get fully established after they're planted.
How active will the North Carolina Coastal Federation be overall in living shoreline construction as far as advising contractors and property owners?
Well, I would say 100% active. We're going to be involved, the staff here in the Ocean office, but as well as our Wanches and Wilmington offices. We're going to be very active in providing recommendations for living shoreline erosion control options. We're going to be very active during the plantings and the construction. We're going to work closely with the property owners as well as with marine contractors that we hope to train through these projects so that they in turn can learn how to put them in. They're very simple and effective. It's not rocket science to put these in, so we hope to get a lot of marine contractors involved and have them shadow us as we put these living shorelines in along the coast.
Now, is this grant program for both private and public waterfront property?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we hope to install up to 20, maybe more depending on funding up and down the coast. Both public and private sites would be applicable for the grant.
Now, how can property owners begin the application process to build a living shoreline?
So if property owners that are interested would go to our website at www.nccoast.org, and there is a link for the Living Shoreline Cost Share application. They can follow that. If you have any problems, feel free to email me at lexiaw@nccoast.org.
Lexia, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
A Durham couple has a unique problem in their publishing efforts, and if they choose to commiserate about their problem with a malted beverage in hand, that's okay. It's just more research for their next published effort, which, given exponential growth in their chosen topical field, could be sooner rather than later. George Olson has more.
Eric Lars Myers and Sarah H. Fickey have what would typically be a devastating problem for authors. They no sooner publish a book and it's out of date.
Even when we hit 45 breweries in the first book, that book was 6 or 8 breweries out of date by the time it even got published a few months later. We have something similar that actually happened with this book. We finished writing it in December, and now there are 176 breweries in the state. So there are almost as many breweries that have opened since we finished writing this book in December as there were in the first book.
Eric Lars Myers talking about the first two editions of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries. The first edition came out in 2012, and as just mentioned, was out of date when it hit stores. This year's second edition profiles 136 breweries and brew pubs around the state, and 40 more have opened over about 8 months' time. Craft breweries are now just starting to take off in North Carolina, propelled by the arrival in 1980 of a German immigrant to the Outer Banks region.
So he was really important because when he came to North Carolina, he came because he was in farming. And when he came to North Carolina, he had this vision of starting up a business like the ones that they had in Germany, where you have a farm that's also a brewery. And when he looked into it, he discovered that it was illegal because the laws that we had were still left over from post-prohibition, essentially. And so people who were producing beer were not allowed to sell it on their own premises. And he thought that this was pretty backwards. And so he basically realized that right around when he was doing this, that wineries had just passed a law in the Senate, in the House in North Carolina, that allowed them to have a restaurant on premises because they wanted to be able to make wine and also have people consume it there. And so what he did is he took that bill and he essentially just went through and crossed out winery and put in brewery. And then he took it back to the legislature and said, hey, you know, here's this bill. I want to get this passed. And it was the same thing that they had just looked at. So they looked at it again and said, yeah, that looks fine. And so he actually got the law changed so that people could make beer and also sell it to people to consume on their premises. And that allowed him to open up Weeping Radish.
Co-author of North Carolina Craft Beer and Brewery, Sarah Fickey, talking about Uli Benowitz, whose arrival in 1980 ultimately brought action in the state legislature in 1985, followed by his first brew pub, Weeping Radish, in 1986. Sarah notes it's not the first big moment in beer history for eastern North Carolina. Christoph von Graffenried arrived in what would become New Bern in 1710. The Swiss nobleman soon wrote a relation in Germany requesting equipment for one thing he found missing in the New World.
That was the earliest mention of brewing in the state of North Carolina that I could find when I was doing my research. And I love it because it was another German immigrant who did the same thing Uli did and wrote home and said, somebody please send me equipment to brew with because there's no beer here. And in his case, his wife knew how to brew, and so he asked them to send him equipment, and they did.
All that history and the work of Uli Benowitz didn't prompt a flood of craft brewers in the state. 15 years after Benowitz's advocacy, only 28 breweries were active in the state. That's when the next great moment in North Carolina beer history occurred, the passage of the Pop the Cap legislation in 2006 that raised the legal alcohol limit for beer.
You know, it sounds a lot like, you know, let's make sure we can all get drunk, but that's really not what it's about. It's really about a breadth of styles and the ability to make a wide array of beers. So 6% alcohol just doesn't have enough range to be able to allow people to make a wide range of, say, Belgian offerings or even German offerings or English offerings. And there's just a lot of variety to be had there. So, you know, there were breweries in North Carolina and they were making really great beer. I think what the real stumbling block is that you didn't have a very excited drinking base at that point. So the customers were not really excited about the variety that was available to them. And when the cap got raised, what you had was a lot of breweries from out of state who were not distributing into North Carolina, who all of a sudden saw North Carolina as a viable distribution alternative. Because if you're a brewery in Michigan or Pennsylvania or something like this, and you have, you know, six beers that you make, and three of them are over 6% alcohol, and three of them are under 6% alcohol, you won't distribute any of them to North Carolina because it's just not worth distributing if you can't distribute your whole portfolio. So for a lot of people who were outside of the state, it just made a lot more sense to not distribute until an entire portfolio was available. And that, I think, brought in a lot of options and variety into the marketplace and got drinkers very excited, which meant that having a brewery here doing a wide array of offerings was a much more viable business.
Still, craft brewers didn't suddenly overflow the North Carolina market. Pop the Cap passed in 2006. By 2010, the number of breweries had crept up from 28 in 2000 to 48. And shortly after Eric and Sarah published their first edition of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries in 2012, the number of breweries was only in the 50s. That's more an indication of the fact breweries are not overnight startups. You want to start a brewery? Don't quit your day job, at least for a while.
Well, I think Pop the Cap was definitely the catalyst. It's what certainly set everything into motion. And, you know, you got to think that, yes, we're only seeing a really big explosion over the past few years, but it takes a long time to start a brewery. You're usually talking 3 to 5 years between coming up with the idea and actually getting equipment set up and brewing. You know, 5 years is a probably generous idea of how long it takes to start one of these businesses. So a lot of this has started over the past decade and is just sort of coming to fruition now.
And Eric Lars Myers further notes an evolution in government thinking about breweries, from prohibition in the early 20th century to state legislation making a craft brewery economically viable to outright courting of brew pubs.
Overall, you see a lot of local governments realizing that breweries are really good for economic growth, and so a lot are trying to attract breweries no matter how they can, you know, giving them tax abatements or in some cases even offers of free rent in buildings just to get something going on. I know Warren County was looking for a brewery for a long time. Greenville has been actively looking to find a large brewery to move in there. People really recognize that breweries have become drivers of economic growth, are a good source of jobs, and of course they're a good source of tourism, and so they bring people into your town to see the town, you know, that they wouldn't necessarily be going there for.
And local breweries aren't just local in the sense they exist in your town. Eric and Sarah say local brewers can come pretty close to producing beer with 100% end-state grown items. Barley is grown and malted in state, though a consistent source of local hops is still a problem. But the biggest single ingredient in any beer is water, and as most craft brewers don't have access to giant water processing facilities, Eric says, you're using your local town's water, so it makes it taste like your local town's water. Just as more restaurants are taking advantage of what their region produces, brewers are recognizing where they're from, putting them firmly in a trend of moving away from a one-size-fits-all mentality that predominated the food and beverage industry for decades.
And frankly, I think we see America going from this great homogenization in the 1950s to the 1970s, in which the pinnacle of food or, you know, achievement in food was making a hamburger that tasted the same way on both coasts, ignoring the fact that America really is this great tossed salad of people, and everybody everywhere has their own particular tastes and wants in terms of the food that they create and the climate that they're living in. And what we're really seeing now is a food economy and a drink economy that's reflecting the actual society that we are, rather than this idea of homogenization.
Eric Lars Myers and Sarah Fickey of Durham are the authors of the second edition of North Carolina Craft Beer and Breweries, published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
Everyone deals with stress in different ways. For some, it's meditation or running. For one woman in Concord, it's an arcade game in the midst of what some might say is making a bit of a comeback. Pinball. She's so good, in fact, she's ranked as the number one player in the state of North Carolina. WFAE's Sarah D'Elia caught up with the local pinball wizard and has this story.
Sunshine Bond stands in front of a Lord of the Rings-themed pinball machine. She does a sort of two-step dance, leaning her body to the left, then to the right, to seemingly will the ball in a certain direction. There's a method to this pinball madness.
I just saved a ball from the out lane by hitting the side of the cabinet a little bit.
That sort of nudging is legal in pinball, by the way. The 41-year-old stay-at-home mom is constantly studying the rules of the game and watching other players in person and on YouTube to pick up new techniques.
Now I've got two balls on my right flipper, going for another ramp shot. I'm gonna see if I can get this ball over to the other flipper.
And the hard work has paid off. Bon is currently ranked the number one player in North Carolina by the International Flipper Pinball Association. Bon was first drawn to the game as a child when her parents took her to an arcade.
I think it was the lights and the sounds. And I would pull up a stool and stand on a stool so that I could look over the glass. And I was always much more interested in playing pinball machines than I was any of the video games.
She's held on to that interest throughout her life. But several years ago, when living in Florida, a local establishment started holding monthly pinball tournaments. So she decided to see what she could do.
And I had never been in a pinball tournament before, but I got second place in the very first tournament that I went to there. And then I was just kind of hooked on competitive pinball.
When her family moved to Concord about 3 years ago, finding the pinball community was one of the first things she did. It's a huge part of her social life, and it's a stress reliever.
There's no problems in my life when I'm playing pinball. It's just joyful. And even when I lose the ball, I'll give a yell, but then, you know, I get another ball.
Pinball, she says, helps her juggle work and play. Meditative is a word she uses to describe the game. It's just her and the ball. And as a parent of a child with special needs, she says the game keeps her balanced.
If I didn't have pinball in my life, it would be just a whole lot of work and a whole lot of stress. And it's so nice to have something that I feel like I'm good at. Raising a child is a long-term project, and you don't know how it's going to turn out until, you know, the end. So, yeah, it's absolutely instantly gratifying to play a pinball machine.
She practices about every other day during the week. Today it's at Save Point Video Games in the University area of Charlotte. Later in the week, it could be Charlotte's latest barcade, Abari in Noda. And on the weekend, she can typically be found playing a tournament somewhere in the state. Small tournaments have a cash prize of $10 to $15, but the bigger the tournament, the larger the cash prize can be. Vaughn is a self-described introvert, but get her talking about pinball and she lights up. It gives her a confidence and sense of accomplishment. And Vaughn enjoys welcoming new people into the pinball community, offering advice or insights to tricks of the trade. But she's got a competitive side too.
And I'm really loud when I lose a ball or a game, especially if I feel like I made a mistake, like I shouldn't have done that. I will yell. But that gets it out of my system really fast.
Yeah, it's like a quick cleanse.
Exactly. Okay. It's a quick cleanse. It's like, ah! And then, all right, now I'm back to my focused gameplay.
For now, Bon is enjoying that number one spot, which can go down depending on the number of tournaments she plays and where she places in them. Her goal is to take her pinball career as far as she can, hopefully one day becoming a world pinball champion, showing everyone, including herself, that she can play a strategic, well-thought-out, and yes, a mean game of pinball. I'm Sarah D'Elia in Charlotte.
Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Summer is a great time to enjoy fresh fruit, and right now I'm enjoying the blueberries and peaches, but I'm also looking forward to the figs and muscadine grapes that will be coming soon. When I finally get my fill, I like to preserve some of summer's bounty to enjoy it through the fall and winter months. And one of my easiest and favorite ways to do that is by making jam. Jam is really just crushed fruit that is set in some way. The traditional way to make jam involves cooking down fruit with sugar until the natural pectin in the fruit causes the jam to gel. This is probably how you remember your grandmother making jam, cooking away on the stovetop. Pectin is a naturally occurring substance that helps hold the fruit cell walls together. As the fruit cooks and concentrates, the natural pectin causes the jam to gently set. The level of pectin varies naturally between different types of fruit. Sour apples, crab apples, and unripe blackberries are naturally high in pectin, while blueberries, figs, and peaches are relatively low in pectin. So some fruits are better suited to this technique than others. To make matters more confusing, unripe fruit has higher levels of pectin than ripe fruit does, so sometimes jam made with just fruit and sugar sets, and sometimes it doesn't set very well. It just depends on the fruit used and its natural pectin levels. For this reason, some people prefer to make jam with a commercial pectin. An example of one such product is SureGel, but there are many brands available. Adding pectin makes it easier to ensure that the jam will set consistently, and the fruit doesn't need to be cooked for as long a period of time. The drawback to commercial pectin recipes is that they tend to call for a lot of sugar, and this can sometimes overshadow the flavor of the fruit itself. If you want to reduce the amount of sugar or use an alternative sweetener, look for a pectin that is advertised for low or no sugar recipes, or one that is marketed as a universal pectin. These products will come with recipes that allow you to reduce or even eliminate the amount of sugar used, or to use an alternative sweetener. People have their own preferences, so try both techniques and see which option you prefer. Cooked jams should only be stored in the refrigerator for a month or so. If you want to store them for longer than that, jams are easy to can. Once you've followed the recipe and your jam is set, you will pack it in clean, sterile jars and process it in a water bath canner. If you don't have a water bath canner, you can use a large stock pot with a lid and a rack in the bottom. Now, there's another option for jam making that doesn't require you to cook the fruit at all, and this is one of my favorites. In these no-cook or freezer jam recipes, you simply clean and crush the fruit and mix it with the prescribed amount of sugar. Then the pectin is mixed with water and heated. Once the pectin mixture achieves a boil and boils for a minute, it is added to the prepared crushed fruit, and then you stir for several minutes. The fruit, since it's not cooked, retains its bright, fresh, just picked flavor, but the pectin causes it to set. You can pack the jam in freezer containers and allow it to sit out for 24 hours to achieve its gel. Then pack it away in the freezer for a little taste of summer sunshine, even during the coldest months. Making jam is an easy way to get started preserving summer's bounty. If you have fruit to harvest in your yard, consider putting up a batch or two. If you don't have any fruit of your own, consider visiting your local farmer's market or farm stand. When wintertime comes around, you'll be glad that you did.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.